Hello, John and Paul. Thank you for joining us. I think you started something called the Parish Collective, which I want to learn about. Could you describe a little bit what it is? And I'm especially interested in what were the conditions in the world and in your world that led you to think you wanted to start something unique and something new?
Well, Peter and John, thank you for having me. And first, let me begin by just saying how honored I am to participate in this conversation and how much the two of you have influenced my life and the life of my colleagues. And it's just an honor to be here. And I can just preface that by saying I can easily blame everything I'm about to say on the two of you. So that's helpful for me.
You're welcome.
But, but the yes, the Parish Collective, the origins. Listen, what happened is in the late '90s, you know, there was an amalgamation of different denominations and church movements that were, you know, a good way to describe it is we, for some reason, thought we should follow kind of the big box methodology of corporations and apply that to our churches. And as a consequence, you ended up having religious movements that were all based around kind of a consumer mindset and getting people into the building. And you know, we have this phrase within kind of clergy circles of butts, budgets, there's one other B and I can't remember, buildings.
Buildings.
yeah, there you go. That's budgets and buildings. And I really, in the late 90s, I began to just have this deep sense that somehow we had lost our way and that we had become infatuated with something that wasn't life-giving at all. And a small group of friends began kind of experimenting with what would it be like if we thought about the neighborhood as the place where you know God's presence and God's spirit was moving, and we could just join in with what was happening there. And this in seed was the beginning for me of a massive transformation in my life. And the Parish Collective was kind of born out of my experiences around that, as well as you both have met my colleague, Tim Sorens, and there are many others involved, even some on this conversation, who have been influential.
So
would you like me to say more?
Well,
about
let me focus a little more. So you're really talking about the corporatization of the church, where scale and size and all of that and reach. I once was in a circle with Rick Warren, who runs a large church in LA, I think. And he says, right now I'm texting 1.1 million followers, you know. And so it was, that really is what you have created an alternative to, and it's a neighborhood focus. How did it change? You said it was a real transformation for you. What was transformed in you? What was that like?
I think I was raised in an environment. You know, one of my favorite sociologists, Manuel Castells, calls it the space of flows, and these are especially frequent on the West Coast, where you have places that have literally unraveled, where we're moving so quickly. You know, you eat in one place, you sleep in one place, you go to school in one place, you go shopping in one place. I mean, we could go on with a myriad of just different locations that we drive to, fly to, and we're moving so quickly that our places with their stories and their characters and their memories just have unraveled. And I was born and raised in that kind of environment. And so I think the biggest kind of transformation was to begin to realize in my loneliness and in my isolation that maybe human beings, the nature of the human species is for connection and for relationship and to be known and to know one another, and starting to think about the neighborhood or the parish, as we often refer to it, as this microcosm of all the dimensions of life. So you have an ecology, you have an educational life, you have a civic life, you have an economic structure, and to say, what would it look like for a group of people to collectively begin to dream about what they want that to look like in their place? This was just a foreign conversation for me at the time, and became something that I became obsessed with imagining if this dream might be possible, and if people might be able to live that way.
One other question. How did that shift what you spent your days talking about and focusing on?
Yes. I think in as it relates to our life around the church, the major shift became moving from the three B's, butts, budgets, and buildings, to what is God up to in our places, and how do we join in with that? And that has to do with, by the scriptures, my tradition, it says the entire law is summed up in one command: love your neighbor as yourself. And so there's this very deep sense that it's all about relationships and all about how we enter into loving, generative, life-giving relationship together. And that becomes the motivation for everything you do, including your church meetings. It becomes this deep desire to say, what will strengthen us and what will actually encourage us and help us to relate together as a community in a loving and life-giving way?
So this is you as the pastor are raising this question with the congregation.
Yes, and with myself. I mean, let me give you just a sample story of just how bad it was for me. When I moved in to the neighborhood and really began to become present there, the idea of running into people that I know in my everyday life in the neighborhood was a foreign concept. The idea of running into people who participated in my church expression was even more foreign. And so for me to walk down the street and run into people that I knew had moved into the neighborhood and become present there in order to be a loving expression and in order to enter into what God was up to there, it was such a radical thing for me and brought such joy to my life to see those people. I have one story that I often tell where we had a particular coffee shop that we would always get our coffee in the morning, Elizabeth and I, my wife. And we would run into people that we knew, and it became such a joy to me that I would often grab a book, I'd walk down to the coffee shop, and there were some bushes near the shop with a set of stairs next to them, and I'd kind of hide behind those bushes and sit on the stairs and just start to read my book. And as different people would walk down the sidewalk that were part of my congregation, I would kind of slip out and just pretend like I was running into them spontaneously. And I would say, can you believe this? Here we are sharing life together in the neighborhood. This is incredible. We are being the church together here in the neighborhood. And it brought me a lot of joy. So I highly recommend deceptive practices if you want to see this thing go in the neighborhood.
Paul, One of the things about neighborhoods and local associations like churches is that churches tend, I think, to be places where people come together because they have some agreed-upon affinity, a particular kind of faith, the way of following a tradition. A neighborhood is usually not that way. A neighborhood is pretty diverse in terms of why people are there and what their beliefs are. And so, in a sense, it seems to me it's a little harder to begin to create connections and bridges if your focus is on the physical neighborhood than it is in a church where you really have gathered people of some kind of like-mindedness. I'm wondering, how do you come to grips with the diversity and lack of immediate affinity in the neighborhood if you come from a church base? How do you make that jump?
Yeah, that's a great question, John. Anybody else want to answer that one? I feel like... Well, first and foremost, I want to say I actually think that our gatherings are actually supposed to be gatherings on behalf of strengthening our lives and exercising our love for one another and our love for those who are different than we are, kind of within that affinity, so that we better to live that out when we're in the neighborhood. So I actually think if the purpose of the gatherings doesn't enhance your capacity to be with people who are different than you in everyday life, you've lost the main reason that you're supposed to gather in the first place. But I'd also say that I've come to believe that the neighborhood or the parish is actually the place where we become formed to be more human. And it is because of the difference in the neighborhood. I could have on the way to this phone call, I could have, say I was driving on the freeway, I flip some people off, I get angry, I get some road rage going, and then I jump on this call and I act like I'm a nice guy, and then you all never know the difference. But if I try that in the neighborhood, I have to wake up to those people the next morning. Mm-hmm. And so there's a very powerful formative effect that the neighborhood can bring. And religious people are supposed to be about that sort of formation. And the very core message for most religious traditions, and certainly for the Christian tradition, which I'm a part of, is that God is the source of our strength to take down that dividing wall between us and to have a conciliatory effect. And so it's actually the very premise of most religious traditions, that our family would go beyond our bloodlines and would become family members with people who are different from us in the community.
Paul, can you give us a very concrete, specific example of what form this takes in your work in a neighborhood, either your own or other ones? What kind of projects, yes. What kind of focus? Because I think that would balance out the kind of spirit that you're giving expression to.
I think at the center of this is churches learning, and this goes for all people, I think. But I mean, as I'm speaking on behalf of churches, I think it is the beginning point is for a person of faith or a group of people who claim faith to begin to inhabit the place that they live together and to begin to listen to that place and listen for where are the redemptive, restorative, conciliatory, beautiful, good things emerging. And as I listen, how can we enter into them? So a concrete way of talking about that is, for example, in our neighborhood, the effort has been to say, how do we take the habits of our everyday life that we have always been doing, and how do we transfer some of those habits into the neighborhood? And so one person might start local banking. Another person says, you know what? I want my entire vocation to be centered in the neighborhood, and they begin a small business there, or they begin some type of economic venture, social enterprise, or another says, I'm going to become the director of the farmer's market, or another says, I used to go to the park outside the neighborhood, and now I want to I'm gonna take my children to the park in the neighborhood, and that you begin inhabiting the neighborhood and listening for the possibilities that might emerge there, so that a collective way of life begins to open up, a collaborative, collective social trust can begin to emerge. So literally in my context, if you walk down the streets in my neighborhood here in downtown Hilltop, Tacoma, Washington, we would be able to walk by a whole spectrum of places, whether they be civic places or economic places or community gardens or any number of environments, and I would be able to introduce you to people who are friends of mine, whether they be part of our particular expression of faith or not, and that we see each other as part of the same team on behalf of the life and flourishing of our neighborhood.
Do you still have a building, a church, and a name?
Well, I don't. And you're talking to, I was often referred to, in the early 2000s when I began making some of these shifts, I was referred to as the church shrinking consultant. And I didn't get very many jobs. But I am part of a intentional Christian community, which refers to it's a group of houses on one block that have some community gardens in them. It's was started by Dorothy Day. It's called the Catholic Worker, and we have a little get together every week. And they've been in here in this neighborhood for 30 years, and they're actually an incredible little community. So I am part of something, but not the initial expression that I began with.
You have the Parish Collective, which is a national sort of network of people, as I've understood it and experienced it once or twice. And I was just wondering, who would you define as the main participants in that collective? Are they mostly people who have some kind of pastoral designation, or are they broader than that?
Oh, great question. Well, Parish Collective was born because of the recognition that there were actually people in every neighborhood, people who claimed faith and were present in their neighborhoods and wanting to love people and do things. We began to discover that this was happening in every neighborhood that we visited, mm-hmm. and from every different denomination, mm-hmm. and from every different sort of expression. So whether it be an intentional community like mine, or whether it be a traditional church environment, or whether it be a church that had been in existence for 100 years, but it it had shrunk down, and maybe you got, you know, maybe a dozen elderly folks in there who absolutely had a history of neighborhood, or you might have a handful of very young people who were catching on to the importance of local community. So the Parish Collective is comprised of churches and faith expressions from just about every denomination and context you imagine.
And if you if we went and took a sample of the people who associate themselves with the group, what would you think most would say distinguishes you from other kinds of organizations that are faith-based?
Yeah, I would say that the distinguishing characteristics are, I'd say, first of all, distinguishing characteristics in terms of these churches and faith communities from others would be that they see their commitment to the parish as central, as a core component of what it means to be human together, and so they see their calling as to exemplify and to point out and bear witness to and join in with others who see the parish as an expression of how we be human together. I think some differentiators are, and I think this is one of the beautiful things, is that because our faith has to do with all components of life, so it has to do with how we act within all the different systems and structures, our leisurely life, our family lives, our economic lives, and so forth. It means that potentially you have a group of people who are asking the question, what does it look like to be faithful here together, to relate together faithfully, one word that your friend Walter Brueggemann says, he talks about fidelity, mm-hmm. and this idea that it's not about following a list of rules, but it's about finding a way of faithful or fidelity-based relationships. And I think that is a major differentiator. So you have a group of people. We have done some research on the groups that have become involved, and we've written a document that refers to five signs that have emerged. And I could briefly share those with you. The first is that they practice following the way of Jesus. And of course, this is within the Christian tradition. But it's a unique differentiator within that, because it's not about following a list of beliefs. It's about practicing a particular way. So it has to do with actual actions and postures. And the second one is inhabiting the neighborhood and becoming a character there, becoming present there in the life of that story. And the third one is that we continue to gather together, but we gather as a rehearsal space of the kind of people that we believe God wants us to be in the community on a daily basis. So the all the different activities that we do in the building are almost a form of exercise that strengthens us to be those type of people in the everyday of the community. And then the fourth one is that we have this open and collaborative posture with those who are different from us, and that we don't imagine ourselves, much like the old parish where you imagined yourselves to have the absolute window on the truth, and mm-hmm. You could dictate to everybody, even if you lived in a, you know, you basically heard your rules from a centralized authority, and that was it. Well, this we've discovered that groups who are sustainable and resilient have this open posture that says, how do we collaborate at the highest level with others that are here, other church expressions, but other businesses, other enterprises, other residents? How do we become the kind of people who can build those bridges and join in meaningful ways? And then finally, the last one, which is actually we've discovered to be quite central to this, but a little bit foreign to the imagination, is that these groups practice linking across places, and they have good habits of intersecting with other communities and other places and learning from the unique practices and ways of being in other places. So you can see that in the city, especially if you have a community that comes from maybe a very wealthy and white neighborhood, and they maybe across on the other side you have a diverse neighborhood who understands all kinds of things about community life that the white neighborhood maybe has lost. And they both need each other. They both have plenty to offer each other, but they need to be able to link in order for that to be discovered. So those five things have been kind of the signs, I guess, that we have seen in churches that are becoming resilient and sustainable in the neighborhood.
This sounds familiar, Paul. I know that you and two others have written a book called The New Parish. And if somebody wanted to delve more deeply into the 5 points you're making, wouldn't that book be a pretty good entry point?
John, God bless you for saying it. that's wonderful. Yeah. No, we'd love that, and absolutely, it kind of lays out our heart around these themes. And there's a growing number of authors and a growing amount of literature around this. And I'd be happy to offer a list to anybody who's interested.
Okay. Let me shift from the collective a little bit, and then we'll open up for questions, Paul. I know at least a couple of pastors here who feel they have to walk a very careful line given the polarized political and kind of consciousness that exists within their congregations. And so, you know, whether it's political differences or whether it's around the president or not, or how socially active we should be, these have always been fault lines. Say a little bit about how you think about that. And how you see that playing out in the context that you live in.
Well, I think the center point that I try to stay within as much as possible. I have many concerns around political opinions and so forth that I hold and express in the context of my neighborhood and in the context of my city and rally behind and get involved in. But I think when it comes to this conversation, I think we have to recognize that without a practice of neighborly life, without a practice of learning how to fit together with people who are different than you are around the core dimensions and the core realities of life, so local economy and how decisions are made in your community and how you care for the land and soil that you're going to plunge your own hands into and the hands of your children, the educational life, you know. We could go on with some of these commons. Without that practice, I hesitate to take seriously the voice of people who have the strongest opinions around these themes at a global level or at an abstract level, but haven't had a practice of learning how to become human that way in the everyday level. So I say that to just say, I feel that there is, feel that our hope politically lies in humans practicing life in diversity at the local level around everyday issues and learning how to fit together as a team, learning how to work together in our differences, and that will be our hope when it comes to the polarity we experience at the national level and even across the globe.
You're really creating an alternative to the globalizing like-minded. Somebody asked a question here because we're about to switch. It said, "Hi, Paul, how do I find God in my neighborhood? What am I looking for when I'm looking for him or her?"
Well,
simple question.
Yeah, this it's a very very good question and a very mysterious question. It's first of all I think it's a very perceptive question in the light of the fact that how you answer that question gives your preconceived ideas of what you think God is like. And so you can have someone who says, "Yes, I'm going to join what God is doing in my neighborhood." And if you think that God is a answer giver and a colonializing force, or you think that God, hates certain types of people, that's not going to be a very good thing for the neighborhood. So I when I answer that question, I think to myself that everything that my scriptures share bears witness to my experience of humanity, which is that what God is after is faithful relationships. And God's dream or hope is that we would find a way of engaging with God, with each other, with the land, with the animals, the ecology of the place, in a way that's life-giving, beautiful, good, a way that brings healing. And I think each community is going to have to work that out, what that means and what that looks like. And whether or not it's God who is energizing that.
So let me thank you. Maggie, why don't you invite callers and others into the conversation?
Sure. So if you've dialed in and would like to join in the conversation, press *8 on your telephone and you'll be put into a queue and I'll unmute you. Or we've also got the chat going for those of you who are on that. Leslie's answered a lot of questions and posted some resources there. There was also one other question that's similar to the last, and that is, how do you detect what God is doing in your neighborhood? What does God do in your neighborhood? So that's one to get us started until we get it.
Thanks. Yes, that's good, Maggie. Well, I another thing I think must be said is oftentimes religious circles have a tendency to silo off certain things as spiritual activities, as religious things, and the most ordinary and everyday of things often get discluded. And I think I think one of the most important things to get after around this is to say, what does it look like when the everyday common elements of life we become concerned about how we relate together in those. So, to give you an example, in my neighborhood, most of the decisions that get made here are made upon people who are going to have to bear the weight of those decisions, and they have very little voice in the making of those decisions. So the civic life, it actually is a very spiritual issue in terms of giving people voice and creating an environment where everyone who's going to be affected by the decisions has some say in what happens. You know, what would it look like if, you know, one word that's often used in some faiths is the word shalom. If shalom was to break out here in our neighborhood, what would the civic life look like? If shalom was going to break out here in the neighborhood, what would the environmental life look like? What would the educational life, the economic life? And I think that's a great question to ask, as you know, as Christians often pray that prayer, Father, you know, your kingdom come here on earth as it is in heaven. I think we can ask the question, what would it look like if heaven was born here on earth? And how do we enter into that in the context of our neighborhood?
Great. Maggie, do you have a phone call you want to invite in?
Yes, we do. This is somebody calling in from Southwest Ohio. So maybe your neighborhood, Peter. Hello.
Hi, this is Mac. I wanted to thank you, Paul, for this conversation, and I wanted to ask a question, kind of a, you know, community building ABCD question. You know, if we're building these communities from the inside out, and the people's motivation to act is one of the first of those assets or gifts that we want to, you know, hear. What kind of practice could you share with us around that from your, you know, inside the congregation, inside the intentional community, and then moving outward? You know, we talk about stewardship and time, talent, and treasure, but the only one we're measuring these days has two decimal places on it. It seems to be the money, and this gift. Motivation as a gift, engagement is something I'm interested in, time and talent-wise.
Yeah, thank you, Mac. Well, let me see if I can say something to it, and then it'd be great to have John and Peter say something that's actually probably more practical. But let me say that a turning point, and I think this is something major, when we talk about ABCD and we're asking the questions about what are the gifts and strengths and assets, if we begin with the neighborhood or the parish as an ecology or as an ecosystem or as a set of relationships that must learn how to resonate, must learn how to fit together, must learn how to collaborate on behalf of its flourishing, then we can begin to ask the questions, what are the gifts? What are the assets? What are the strengths? Until you wrestle with the parish as kind of this fundamental ecology for being human together, until you have actually kind of wrestled with that and said, yes, that's what we're looking for, then the strengths and the gifts will always be up for you to decide and determine. Like you can, you know, basically look at someone and say, I think their gift is helping me make $1 million. But once you ask questions about gifts and strengths as it relates to the ecology of the neighborhood, I think it starts to reshape your actions. So now you're on the lookout. Firstly, you're listening. What are the hopes and dreams as it relates to the neighborhood and other people in the neighborhood here? And where are the things happening in this neighborhood that contribute to that? John, Peter, what would you say in response to the question?
John?
Yeah. I'm trying to think about I mean, my mind has wandered a bit to this. In as a faith community manifests the kind of mutual commitment and covenant that I think, Paul, you're describing, living another way, and then it looks out to the neighborhood and says, how do we establish relationships there, especially because there may be people who are different. One of the things that I am troubled by is how often that looking outside has a name called Christian service. And the reason that I think is troubling is that it has the sense of Lord and servant, that somehow I've got it, they haven't. And it isn't very reciprocal. It doesn't lead to, I think, faithful relationships. And so how do I take this community that is my faith group and manifest it in ways that aren't about service, but that are about something else? I would use the word friendship.
And by service, I think, John, you mean charity, philanthropy.
That kind of thing. I got it, you don't, I'll fix you, you poor soul, I'm going to do something for you. Always from a superior position. And I think that is not authentic, and that motive and that way of acting doesn't lead to the kinds of relationships beyond the church that are authentic, and I would even use the word Christian. I'm just wondering what you think about that.
What do you think about that, Paul?
Okay, so your answer to Mac was a question to me. I got you. I know how you
quit stalling, Paul.
Listen, both of you have been so influential for me around this theme. I just can't even believe it when you think about how far the church has as a whole, and this probably is true for many faiths, that we have lost this kind of core dimension of friendship and this core dimension of we open up the agency of the other when we open up our own need and we offer our gifts and we offer our need and we become a team together. We become we become community of friends together. That are equally sharing with one another and supporting one another. I think you've tapped into something on this, John. That it gets at the. It's a painful point for us who have been a part of the church, because we've literally based almost everything we are about kind of having the answers and serving it up to others. The community that I'm a part of here in downtown Tacoma, they offer themselves every day on behalf of those who don't have homes, on behalf of people coming out of the detention center, immigrants and refugees from all over the world. But they honestly and truthfully, I have watched them, they receive people as gifts and as they literally imagine to themselves, this might be the very person that our community needs to become what we are to become, to become mature, to become a life-giving group, to be able to touch and bless and help others. We had one fellow, Alfredo, who has passed away from cancer, who came 20 years ago to this community with no birth certificate, no family, no, I mean, had a ravaged history, on the go, on the run, landed in our little community, and this was prior to my arrival, and the community members said, we have been waiting for someone who speaks Spanish who will be able to help us to connect to the broader neighborhood. And this guy became an intrinsic part of the neighborhood. And when he died, we wept tears. His life was celebrated. He was known and transformed by it, and we were known and transformed by it. And I just can't think of any other way now. I wouldn't want to think of any other way of participating together.
Yes, everybody has an unexpected gift, you're saying, and I think that's true.
We have another caller, Maggie. Go ahead.
John, let me just say, before you go there, let me just say, I can walk three blocks down the hill, and I can see institutions that have been built to serve old people, and what they really are is a place for old people to die and become irrelevant to the community. So here you got somebody who's probably followed all the right things, and now they're up in the top of these towers, unknown to the community. And then you got this guy, Alfredo, no birth certificate, no family, and surrounded by love and care and offering contribution and value to the community. That's the way that I want to, that's what I want to foster, you know?
Yeah. Wonderful.
Do we have a caller still?
Yes, we do.
Hello?
Why don't you invite him in? Hello, Peter. Welcome.
Can you hear me?
Yes, very well.
Okay. Yeah, this is Peter again, another Peter here. I am a witness to Paul. I think that Paul represents the best that this country has to offer. I live in Silicon Valley, and both in business and in the academy, the motto is STEM, science, technology, engineering, and math, period, that's considered an education. And what Paul makes clear that what a real education is how a human being shows up in the world. And how he shows up in the world, I think, follows St. Augustine's famous statement that I must first have faith before I can understand. And that doesn't require any theoretical explanation. It simply is how he comes across in this presentation. And I think it is magnificent, it is inspiring, and it is a dimension of human existence which says human relationships, the awareness of another human being, and decisions that you make in connection with having intimacy or contact with other human beings, that is what matters. And I just want to be a witness to that. And it's wonderful. And I just want to, that's all I have to say. This is not about STEM, which many people consider an education. This is about experiencing another consciousness, another awareness, reaching out and connecting, and how wonderful that is. That's what this country is all about. So that's just a thank you. And that's really all I have to say.
Thank you, Peter.
You're welcome.
There's a question that a little while ago may be a way to bring us to a close too soon, Paul. And it says, another simple question, what is the future of the church in your eyes? Is it more of a parish model?
Oh, man, I hope so. I hope so. We can just live into this together and see what comes of it. I think above and beyond all things, I would hope that we change the question from the future of the church per se, because if we ask, you know, my friend Al Roxborough, he says we have to stop asking church questions like how do we save our churches, how do we rebuild our churches, how do we get our churches going again, and we have to ask the question of what is the Spirit up to in our neighborhoods, and how do we join in? And so I hope that the future of the church is to join in with the future of our neighborhoods.
Well, thank you. There's one other question. Let me just honor it. And maybe, you know, we're running out of time, but it says, how do communities build social collaborative trust? And I'm thinking that maybe everything you've said up to now is an answer to that, but you might just have a quick comment on that, Paul, and then we got to honor the time.
I'll say a quick word and just say, firstly, we have to become present and committed. That's the first thing. We have to not take lightly our actual presence in the community, in the neighborhood. And then two, we have to not diminish the relationships there, whether they be other people or whether they be the land and animals, that we have to recognize that the relationships are full of mystery. And what that means for me is not that they are unknowable, but that the journey of relationship and the risk of relationship is ongoing. So if you think you have dissolved the mystery in someone, then you treat them the way that John said, as a client who you have the answer for. If you think that they are absolutely unknowable, you give up and you don't do anything. But if you think that you can risk a relationship and you take time and imagination and creativity and presence, and when you make mistakes, you get back up and you adapt and you go ahead again, that has the recipe for possibility and for community.
I like that distinction between unknowable and ongoing. That's wonderful.
Yeah.
So any thoughts, John, final comments you want to make? And we'll get one from you, Paul, and I'll close with one. Gratitude for you being here. Go ahead, John.
Glad to have you, Paul. And I want to, once again, for people who want to follow up, mentioned that you can read a book, I think, that was generative of the Parish Collective called The New Parish, and Paul's an author, Tim Searns. And then the third author is, Paul?
Oh, yes, Professor Dwight Friesen.
Yes. So I think that's a wonderful point of expansion of the kinds of orientation that Paul is presenting. And then the other thing is that you have a website called the Parish Collective, and it's a good way for people who are interested in being connected to others who have these kinds of visions to begin that journey. So you have wonderful resources for people to follow up on the kinds of vision we've been talking about.
So I want to add, Paul, in one of your five items, you said be a character in your neighborhood, and that just jumped out at me. I think that's a wonderful way of, it's a liberating way of asking people to show up and being willing to be a character and have a presence and a cast a shadow in the neighborhood. And I think there's a political dimension of focusing on the neighborhood as enough. That's extremely powerful, and I just totally support that. And you know, the work that Walter and John are doing, to me, in my mind, has come to the idea of neighborly economics, and that may be what we're really striving for, is to bring the economy and friendship and neighborliness into being together, having all those same qualities. So thank you for the work you're doing. Any final thought you have, Paul, that you'd like to express?
Well, I love that word, character, as well. It reflects being part of the story of your place.
Yeah.
If you're a person of faith, being part of the story of what God's doing, but it also reflects the idea that characters, you know, if a person's a character, you get the idea that once you become known, all of us are a little bit whacked. All of us are, you know, we're all characters, unique characters. And so I like that aspect of it. And I'll just say in closing, I just want to once again affirm my gratitude for what the two of you have been up to is unbounded. And I have so much hope because of the work that you've been doing. And I will say it from my Christian tradition. I pray that God will bless you and strengthen your lives and give your voice so much breadth and hope for people.
Thank you, Paul. It's very kind. Maggie, you want to bring us home?
Yes, I will. Thank you, Paul. That was a wonderful conversation today, and we appreciate your taking the time to be with us. And I want to say thank you to the listeners and those who participated in the chat, and Mac and Peter for calling in. Our next conversation will be on Tuesday, March 27, and that will be with Ann Livingston, who's the founder of the Vancouver Area Network of Drug Users. And until then, please visit our website, abundantcommunity.com, and stay in touch with us on the web and on Facebook. So this brings our program to a close today, and thank you everyone for joining.